The unemployment rate ticked down slightly last month to 7.5% in April compared to 7.6% in March. But the unemployment rate for African Americans remains much higher at more than 13%. Our guest in this half hour discovered a different explanation than overt racial discrimination for this difference. Is the culprit favoritism and social networks? Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 7:37 on this Thursday, May 16th. We were intrigued when we saw our guest's piece in the New York Times recently. It was headlined, "How Social Networks Drive Black Unemployment." And we invited her to talk with you about this. Do you think social networks play a part in African-American unemployment? Are social networks more exclusive than inclusive? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Nancy DiTommaso. She is Vice Dean for Faculty and Research at Rutgers Business School. She is also the author of the book, The American Dilemma, which provides a comprehensive examination of the persistence of racial inequality in the post-civil rights era. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. So how do social networks drive African-American unemployment?
Well, in the study that I did, I was primarily looking at white employment as opposed to black unemployment. But one of the things that I found in the people that I interviewed was that 70% of the jobs that they held over their lifetimes included some kind of additional insider help from someone. Either in terms of getting information that other people didn't have, such as when was a company hiring and what did one need to do in order to get that type of job, having someone use influence on their behalf, such as saying, this is my friend, take care of them, or someone who could actually offer them a job. And so when you think about the fact that 70% of the time there's some kind of insider help, then it raises questions about who is in the networks of the people who are helping others get jobs. And because we live such segregated lives still, then it's quite likely that if whites are primarily helping other whites, that it will have an impact on people who are not in those networks.
Yeah, so what do we mean by social networks?
Well, as I just indicated, we defined it in terms of getting information, influence, or opportunity from someone else, family, friend, acquaintance, that has some kind of impact in terms of the ability of someone to get a job.
Okay. I mean, we're not, I guess I just wanted to make sure we're not talking necessarily like participation on Facebook or something like that.
No.
Yeah.
This is not that sort of network.
Right. So is this trend geographical?
No. I did interviews with people in different parts of the country, so it isn't limited to a particular state or region. And it also is not only recent, because I interviewed people about their job histories from the time they were in high school until the time I did the interviews, so we're talking about over their entire lifetimes. And we looked at the proportion of people who had some kind of help in the first job, the second job, the third job, and so on up until about the 10th job. And what we found is that even the very first job, which were mostly jobs in high school or maybe college, that about half the time people got help, and then it increased from there up to 60 or 70%, as I said, 70% on average across all these jobs over the lifetime. There was a difference between men and women. Women on average had help about 60% of the jobs they held, and for men it was up to 75%. So, in other words, a very high number. And, again, if one's thinking about what do we mean when we talk about a job market, if so many jobs are essentially wired where someone can get the job because they know someone or they know someone who knows someone?
Yeah. So you call this trend favoritism, not necessarily racism.
Yes. One of the things that was clear to me when I first started thinking about this issue is that all of the academic literature, much of the media, when they talk about issues of racial inequality in jobs or any other thing, they primarily frame it in terms of discrimination or racism. And essentially they're saying whites are doing bad things to black people, or whites somehow have these hostile feelings toward black people, and that's the problem. And if we could just fix that problem, then we wouldn't have racial inequality. But what I found, and what I try to argue in this book, The American Non-Dilemma, is that it isn't really so much about that dynamic as it is that whites are doing good things for other white people. And that is what is contributing to the reproduction of racial inequality, and we haven't been thinking about the issue in that way. And in fact, while discrimination may be illegal, favoritism or helping your friends and family members and acquaintances is not illegal. And therefore, it's a very different dynamic, and it's one that has presumably different kinds of solutions if you believe that there's something that needs to be done about that.
Yeah, what are some of the solutions to favoritism?
Well, again, there aren't any specifically legal solutions right now, but one of the issues that I want to raise by calling attention to this issue is whether there might be a public policy issue about the way that jobs are passed along to family and friends and others in the job market. The civil rights movement, as we recall, of course, was all about access to jobs and freedom. And at some point, there was a decision that it was not acceptable for blacks and others to be excluded from certain kinds of jobs. But again, we thought about exclusion as purposely keeping them out and did not pay attention to the issue about the fact that whites were making sure that other people got in. And so I'm trying to raise the issue about is there something that we should attend to in terms of understanding that dynamic, whether we talk about affirmative action or some other kind of accountability. It seems that there should be some kind of public attention and concern about the fact that this is primarily how people get jobs.
And I do apologize. I had the name of your book wrong, or I misspoke. It's The American Non-Dilemma.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, Racial Inequality Without Racism. And we are talking about an aspect of that with our guest for this half hour. Nancy D. Tomas is a vice dean for faculty and research at Rutgers University Business School. And we're talking about a piece that she wrote for the New York Times on how social networks drive black unemployment. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's going to be a sunny, mild day today. We can expect high temperatures in the 70s. And stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after 8 o'clock, we will be talking with Temple Grandin. She is a professor at Colorado State University. She's the author of many books, and she has autism. Her latest book is The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. And we'll talk with her about the latest in research about autism, diagnoses, treatments. That's coming up after 8 o'clock. Right now, we are talking with a guest about what drives black unemployment and how social networks play a role in black unemployment. And welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Ralph in Suamico is our first caller. Hello, Ralph.
Yes, hello. I've been listening, and maybe there's going to be solutions coming up a little bit later, but it just seems like networking is something that's been going on for as long as I can remember. My father during the Depression got his job because he knew someone who knew someone at Ellis Chalmers in that case. And I don't know if the solution is to make it illegal. Most managers, most people that are in business would much rather work with someone they know than to bring in someone that they don't know how they're going to perform. So the closer the relationship, the more likely you are to get hired. But I think it's just a fact of life, and I hate to see the government say, well, you can't do this anymore, and if they did, I'm not quite sure how you'd enforce it.
Mm-hmm. Nancy?
Well, I think that it's true that this is quite widespread. But again, this was also widespread before the Civil Rights Movement was passed. And there was a recognition at that point that there was, that particularly for access to certain kinds of jobs, that in this case it was government contractors, jobs at government contractors, that there was a public interest in making sure that those jobs were more broadly available. And so I'm trying to raise the issue of whether that, in fact, is still the case. And as you remember, when the Civil Rights Movement was passed in 1964, essentially not much changed for several years, for a couple years at least, until there were affirmative action guidelines and companies had to begin to report the distribution of the people that they were hiring, and then there was some attention to those issues, and that's when hiring practices began to change, because companies had to have explicit policies, they had to pay attention, they had to count. And so, again, that those sort of practices have fallen away over the last several decades, and there's not nearly as much attention to those issues. And in many companies, even the ones that talk about their commitment to a more diverse workforce and argue that they need to have more diversity among their employees because of the kinds of markets that they are in and the globalization of their enterprises, et cetera, are not necessarily paying attention to these kinds of issues. And what they're doing is simply reproducing the existing labor force. And, again, I think that there are some conversations that need to go on about these practices and whether there is something that should be done.
Nancy DeTomas is a professor and vice dean for faculty and research at Rutgers Business School, author of The American Non-Dilemma. And our next caller is Victor in Milwaukee. Hello, Victor.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning to your guest. You know, this problem, as Ralph said and has been discussed, has been going on even for, I would say, for centuries, not just decades. What favoritism is the same term that's been used over decades, is the good old boy network. You know, it goes back decades. And to me, if you call it favoritism, it's just another, you're watering it down to what it really is. It is a form of racial discrimination. And we all do it. It's, you know, when black Americans do it, or people of Spanish-speaking descent do it, it's no less right or wrong. It is all a form of discrimination. That is why, and you said before, you had affirmative action to counter this good old boy network. Was discriminate, or what do you call affirmative action, was it always right? Did it solve the problem? Sometimes it did, sometimes it didn't. I call it a necessary evil.
Yeah. DeTomas?
Yes, let me respond to that, is that while the outcomes may look very similar in terms of a process of favoritism versus a process of discrimination, again, the context of it is really very different, because discrimination is illegal, but favoritism is not. And people think about it differently because of that, and also there are not the same kinds of access to remedies. And it's important to understand as well that one of the reasons that, again, I'm calling attention to this in terms of whites helping other whites is that the data are pretty clear that there's still disproportionately whites have access to better jobs, higher paid jobs, jobs at higher levels of authority, And to the extent that that is the case, then they are much more well, they're much better positioned essentially to help their friends and family members. And because of that, again, we are reproducing racial inequality through this mechanism.
Yeah. So could African Americans expand their social networks?
Well, they can and they do, and I'm sure that it is true that every group, as the caller said, tries to help people that they know and people who are like them. But again, it depends on who has access to what kinds of jobs. I found in the study that I did that it really didn't make a difference whether it was a large company, a small company, a public agency, a private firm. Jobs were found through this mechanism of someone helping others across all of these different contexts, whether they were affirmative action or equal opportunity employers or not, because people in those companies essentially took responsibility for helping their friends through giving them access or more access to the to jobs in their employer, in their companies where they worked. So even in companies where supposedly there is a fair process and there are various policies in place and employment steps that have to be gone through to select someone, still it's the case that the people who are being chosen and who are standing out are the ones that have some kind of extra help, at least a large proportion of the time.
Anything else, Victor?
No. Thank you. Thanks for bringing it up. It is food for thought.
Thank you very much, Victor. Appreciate the call. Let's go next to Monica in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi. I think that I'm not sure that public policy is going to either be able to stop it or is really the appropriate way to stop it. I know having received help like that or given it, a lot of times it's almost like a job recommendation, you know, where someone will say, hey, I know someone who would be great for that job. So then, oh, they get looked at and they get hired. So it isn't necessarily with the, I mean, I think her point is that it's not intentionally racist and it may come out that way, but I don't see whether it would be possible to stop it through public policy. And I don't think that aside from their nepotism policies they already have, that companies would necessarily want to stop it because it is a valid way to get qualified people. When you hear like, oh, one of your employees knows someone or whatever, and here's a good recommendation. So I'm not sure that's an appropriate way to do it. Maybe just encourage the minorities to do it more, although they already do.
Nancy DeTomas.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to say that that when we think about companies wanting to hire someone that was recommended by their current employees. And in fact, that practice is also fairly widespread, including among companies that claim that they are very committed to having a more diverse workforce. But if you think about the whole issue of nepotism, as the caller raised, it is not the case that you can assume that the people who are known to current employees and are given some additional advantages because of that are necessarily better qualified. They may or may not be. But if you think, for example, of the classic movie It's a Wonderful Life and Uncle Billy, who worked at the bank, I mean, this is sort of an image of when you hire friends and family members, you may get people that, in fact, are not particularly well qualified or well suited. And that's why many companies in the past had nepotism rules. That wasn't a government policy. That was often a company policy. And it also is why there is some reason to have attention to whether we are simply reproducing the existing labor force the hiring process. And in doing that, whether, in fact, we are missing out on the development of the skill level for others who might be able to take those jobs and do very well in them. So I do think that there are some issues that need to be addressed, and as the previous caller said, food for thought.
And a very quick one from Chris in Oneida. We're just about out of time, Chris.
Just real short, I think some of it's cultural. It's also the fact that anybody wants their children to do better than what they've done before. So whether it be, you know, if you're looking at it from our culture or if you're looking at it from where I live with the Menominee, you know, the chances of you moving up in the casino per se, because it is trying to help their culture out. It's not geared towards our culture. So I think you're going to find this across the board. If it was, say, a family-run industry by a black person, they would want their family to do better. I think somewhat it's being skewed.
Let me say...
And we have just a minute to go.
Sure. That all the people that I talked to said that they believed in equal opportunity. But in fact, when you think about it, this process suggests that everyone is seeking unequal opportunity. Everyone's looking for an advantage or a way to get ahead. And I think that that's something that we need to understand and attend to, particularly if we're concerned about issues of inequality.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Nancy DeTomas is Vice Dean for Faculty and Research at Rutgers Business School. She is author of The American Non-Dilemma. And thanks very much to Robin Cherry for producing this program. Thanks to Christy Taylor, Cynthia Schuster, and Bill Martins for on-air production and direction. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. A reminder that we will be hearing from two other U.S. representatives next Tuesday between 7 and 8. We have invited, and they have accepted, Republican Representative Reed Ribble, who will be with us from 7 until 7:30 next Tuesday, and Representative Mark Pocan, who will be with us from 7:30 until 8. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.